Achtung, Achtung. Hier ist die Sendestelle Berlin im Voxhaus. Meine Damen und Herren.
Welcome to the Achtung History Podcast. Presented by myself, Simon J. James, and produced by the BerlinTourGuide.com. This week, the Battle for Friedrichshain. The atmosphere not only in the Saalbau was charged, but all across the Reich. The situation within Germany was critical. As politicians desperately attempted to quell their former enemies and bring resolutions that might offer Germany a future, the number of unemployed was rising. In the space of just a few weeks, the number of unemployed had risen vastly. In January 1931, 2,396,000 people were receiving payments from the unemployment insurance to which they had contributed. 739,000 were on emergency payments from the government, with a further 1.7 million either receiving money from other funds or no money at all. The total number was 4,765,000 unemployed. Industries were struggling to justify the manufacturing of products for a populace that could no longer afford to purchase. Factories were closing, miners had their wages slashed, as the cost of bread soared and the Chancellor sought to deflate the economy. The government at the top was towered over by Heinrich Brüning. Brüning, who had ruled over the Weimar Republic as Chancellor, as the first to rule independently of Parliament. As a finance expert, he had been appointed to bring stability to an economy that was in tatters. He ruled without a Parliament and by decree of the emergency powers granted on to the President by Article 48 of the Weimar Constitution. He was turning out to be no one's friend and everyone's enemy. The people of Germany were paying more money into unemployment insurance, but those unemployed were receiving less benefits. The sick, the invalid, the war wounded and old saw their state payments diminish and fall away. Together with the workers and unemployed, they struggled to afford the food to put into their mouths. They were unified in their suffering, but divided on solution, and they collected in Friedrichshain. The winter was very much still hanging over Berlin. Temperatures fluctuated into the minus degrees Celsius at night, and in the day, when the sun shone from clear blue skies, the temperature did little to bring the mercury higher than reading 4. Hands were driven deep into the pockets to protect them from the chill. Clothes worn were often tatty, as many could afford new or even the repairs to the old, but they braved the air nevertheless. The papers had been crying out that proceedings were to begin at 8:30 in the evening, but so charged was the atmosphere in the city that workers from Red strongholds in Wedding, Neukölln, Friedrichshain and alike had poured into the streets early to meander by foot, tram, S-Bahn, bus or U-Bahn to the Butzow-Viertel in Berlin's Friedrichshain. There stood an ornate building set back from the road that took its name from the park that in turn gave its name to the district, Friedrichshain or Friedrichsgrotto. The building was large, designed in the style of the Italian Renaissance and stretched 43 metres long, 25 metres wide, and rose to 16 in height. It presented itself to those approaching across a field of metal and wooden tables and chairs that filled the expansive beer garden as if it were an early railway station of the city. Two great towers rose, one on either side of an arch that was filled with glass and ornate brick. There was no denying that it was grand. Opened as a multipurpose event space in 1890 as part of an expansion of the Aktien Brauerei Friedrichshain, which had evolved from Lips Brauerei, which belonged to one of the earlier bottom-fermenting breweries of Berlin, or lager breweries, it sung of the heights that the brewery had once enjoyed. Forming a complex that included bandstands, bowling alleys, pavilions and outside seating, with the Schweizgarten accommodated the masses in their thousands. But the more recent years had not been kind. The brewery that had owned the Schweizer Gartens, the Schneider Brauerei, had fallen out of business before the Great War. The Great War, whose conclusion had been the Treaty of Versailles, that had caused much of the financial troubles of the German economy since. Troubles in the German economy that the Weimar Republic had struggled to resolve. that had also claimed the Aktienbrauerei in 1921. Now the opulence of the Zaubau, Friedrichshain, resonated with a grandeur of a time that was firmly in the past. So the disgruntled waded through the tables in the beer garden, whilst those of a middle class at home tuned in on the radio to listen to programmes broadcast from Berlin's suburb of Königswusterhausen. Programmes on the modern capitalism, presented by Dr. Werner Zombart, or the nature and value of astrology by Elmer Brecker and Robert Henseling. Die Rote Fahne, the Red Flag, the newspaper of the Communist Party of Germany, the KPD, based on Bürloplatz in the Karl Liebknecht House, had proclaimed to their proletariat that they, the masses, should gather that evening, the 22nd of January 1931, at the Zaubau Friedrichshain. In large letters, mixing the typeface of the old fracture with the new, they had proclaimed, "In the struggle against fascism, we attack." Fascism to the communists didn't necessarily mean the National Socialist Party of Germany, its Führer Hitler, and his attack dog, the propagandist, Berlin Gau leader and member of the Reichstag, Joseph Goebbels. To the communists, fascists meant any party that was to the right of their own position. Since 1928, with the Sixth Comintern in Moscow, the Third Period had been declared by Joseph Stalin. The First Period had been the uprisings that had followed the Great War. In Berlin, communist uprisings of January 1919 that had been brutally suppressed, in which the KPD lost its key leaders, Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg. The second was the consolidation of the structure of the capitalist market of the 1920s, and the third was to take place with the fall of the economies that was to radicalize the working class, but which would be hindered by the governments. Declared in 1928, it came before the economic crisis of 1929 when Wall Street crashed, but it, led by Stalin, had crucially declared the idea of social fascism. The KPD of Germany had been tied closely prior as the left hand of the Social Democrats who, with the federalized government system in Germany, governed the Free State of Prussia. Now the Social Democrats and their Prussian government under Otto Braun were classified as the left hand of fascism and therefore the enemy, and it was time to mobilize the masses. Breaking from the movement that was to mobilize the working masses in the age-old communist ideal of seizing the means of production, due to unemployment, the KPD was looking to mobilize the unemployed, which in Germany numbered in the millions. The Rote Fahne called on its readers to stuff the mouth of Joseph Goebbels, who was to be the main speaker at the event, an event arranged by the NSDAP at the Zaubau Friedrichshain, to which Goebbels had invited members of the Social Democrats to speak, the Reichsbanner, the paramilitary organizations whose purpose was to defend parliamentary democracy, and who had declined to attend, as well as the chairman of the KPD in Berlin and Brandenburg, Walter Ulbricht. The event was open, hence the crowds that were charging forward now toward the Zaubau Friedrichshain. The NSDAP and Goebbels, who had arranged the event, had opted not to create the event as a ticketed event, something to which the Rote Fahne at least saw as an attempt to launch a coup against the members of the Social Democrats and Walter Ulbricht to drown them out with heckles and boos from the members of the Sturmabteilung, the SA, who Goebbels had planned to fill the hall with. The Rote Fahne saw this and called for its supporters to arrive on time, preferably before 7. The foundations had been laid for a fierce evening battle. An event scheduled to begin at 8:30 in the evening had crowds hammering forward towards the doors of the Zaubau, a Zaubau that had, upon opening, been the largest gathering space in Europe, but now was struggling to allow all those who had made themselves present in. Underneath the glowing lights of the Pilsata sign that hung above one of the tower entrances, the throng of people pushed up and toward the door. It was as unified as the politicized masses of Berlin were to be. Here in the dark of the winter's night, with light from a beer logo and the wash of the electric bulbs that hung from the great chandeliers of the interior, providing the only illumination on the pale faces of those gathered, could they be seen as men and women standing in unison with only one goal, to get in. Indeed, the workers had shown themselves promptly. By 7:30, against a great wave of those last desperate individuals demanding to be let in, pushing forth with their might, were the heavy doors of the Zaubau, the concert hall, forced closed. Disgruntled would-be attendees lined the beer garden as the police and the Schuppo watched on. The police, who found themselves to be neither friend nor ally of either the Nazis or the communists. They were seen as the tool of the Social Democrats by the communists, and the reaction of the police in May in 1929 had, to the communists of Berlin, supported the whole ideology of the Third Movement. When street protests by the KPD had been banned, the KPD had chosen to rile its supporters up and ignore the orders, resulting in actions of the police to end the street protests, which themselves resulted in the deaths of over 30 people and came to be known as Blood May, and reaffirmed to the KPD that social democracy was the left hand of fascism. Now, with watchful eyes, the police were looking over those outside so that the street battles that were a common enough place in Berlin would not break out here. Inside, the Vossische Zeitung, a more respectable newspaper printed in Berlin than the Rote Fahne, would report that half of the hall was made up of communists. Naturally, an estimate to which the Rote Fahne and the communists disagreed with, claiming themselves that the hall was full of the supporters of Goebbels, and that only a small number of communist workers were allowed in. As those outside stood around hoping to catch the speeches that echoed within the hall escape onto the exterior breeze, those who had managed to make it in took their seats. Tables and chairs had been laid out, not the metal durable tables that were expected to pass through every season in the beer gardens, but wooden tables bedecked in tablecloths on which beer glasses and mugs were rested as eyes turned towards the stage. The stage was set before a great organ. Lead pipes rose high within a wooden structure that finished in a pediment that pointed towards the vaulted ceiling and the gilding of gold that crowned the recess in which it was set. Corinthian columns decorated lavishly, with bases ornamentally carved with all the grandeur of the Wilhelminian age that had ended 13 years prior. Capitals supported an entablature of further fluid carvings before a ceiling painted in rich colours of the Italian Renaissance. Upon the stage itself, the gilding stopped. Upon the parquet flooring was placed a table from the hall, under which seats had been set and now were occupied by those invited. Two members of the Social Democrats, Walter Ulbricht of the KPD, a seat occupied by the chairman of the meeting, and two speakers from the NSDAP. But there was an obvious element missing from the picture, that of Joseph Goebbels. At the scheduled time of 8:30, despite the doors having been closed an hour earlier, the chairman raises to his feet. Standing now, he gazes around the room, looking on the odd collection of men and women gathered, those from the extremes who wear bitter looks upon their faces, their ears closed to anything other than the words of their own, their bellies full of words to be shouted and noises to be made, as well as those who had gathered for an evening's debate, who may have been the ones who wore the more placid looks upon their faces. The chairman raises his voice. Broadcasting over the heads of those on the hall floor below, his voice echoed around the room as he spoke.
The owner of this establishment has deferred on to me the household rights that will allow me to take action against each and all troublemakers within this room.
He speaks whilst his gaze crosses the room. With ferocity, he speaks the same words again. And for all those who may not have heard, for they whispered in conversation, muttered their plans, smuggled secret orders around the room, he repeated again, and one more time again, the law that had been passed on to him to maintain order, whatever necessary that evening, within the hall. With the fourth and final warning thrown to the masses, he ordered the evening to proceed. The first to stand before the lectern were the party that had organized the meeting, the National Socialist Party of Germany. It was no secret that Goebbels himself leaned towards the more socialist part of the National Socialist Party, a position in the earlier days that had led to trouble between himself and the party's leader, and still presented issues occasionally. But with so many of the workers in Germany unemployed and disgruntled, he knew he needed to capture upon their anger of their situation and bring them into the fold of the NSDAP, rather than the hands of the KPD. So the first two to speak were a factory hand and a head worker, according to Die Rote Fahne, briefed and placed forward to declare Goebbels' position on Marxism. In reality, the factory hand was Robert Schulz, NSDAP Reichstags member in Stettin, and second, the so-called head worker, was Dr. Meinshausen, a press officer for the NSDAP. In 1927, Goebbels had, for Der Angriff, a newspaper founded as the party paper in Berlin in 1927, written a pamphlet that outlined the position of National Socialism, simply entitled The Nazi Sozi. It was amongst his first published works. His earliest work, a semi-autobiographical novel in three parts entitled Michael, would not go to press until 1929. In Nazi Sozi, Goebbels writes,
"You speak of socialism, but after a 60-year struggle for socialism, which has resulted in the complete undoing of the idea of the state, is the German worker not justified in despairing of socialism and the future of his social class? Never. Consider. 1. He has not fought for 60 years for socialism, but for Marxism, and Marxism, with its theories destructive of peoples and races, is the exact opposite of socialism. 2. Marxism was never the German worker's ideal of the state. He accepted this humble of Jewish ideas only because there were no other choices open to him in his struggle for the freedom of his class. 3. Marxism is the graveyard not only for the national people, but also particularly for the one class that fights wholeheartedly for its realization, the working class. It is therefore not the worker's right to give up on socialism, but rather his duty to give up on Marxism. The sooner he does so, the better for him."
He then finishes on a pro typical of a propagandist, either left or right, a statement of urgency.
"The clock is about to strike midnight."
To the press, especially the Rote Fahne, whose presence at the hall is dubious, neither of the two NSDAP speakers were able to make an impression on the crowd. For half an hour they ranted on their theories of Marxism, but the lack of the presence of Goebbels, who was able to captivate a hall, was noticeable to say the least. Die Rote Fahne reported,
"It was a lamentable stammering, which they presented to the assembly for an hour and a half. The workers present laughed. Surely they did not expect so much stupidity. The faces of the SA polls are getting longer and longer. One SA leader, realizing the stupidity of his own speakers, explains to a worker, muttering, 'These are no leaders, these are two plums.'"
As the Rote Fahne wrote, the two plums spoke for an hour and a half to the crowd. The communists, who appeared to swell in number when the Rote Fahne needed, jeered with thunderous voices that drowned out the hall, despite reporting in the first instance only a small number were able to attend. Nevertheless, orchestrated almost perfectly, as the arses sat once again upon their arses, the doors of the hall were flung open once again. There walking, a slight limp from a birth deformity, and surrounded by members of the elite bodyguard unit, the Schutzstaffel or SS, was Joseph Goebbels. Whilst the workers had been prompt and more than punctlish, Goebbels was arriving to his own event an hour and a half late. It was an irony that he was surrounded by the SS, an organization that he had been lambasting earlier that same day in a meeting with Chief of the SA Ernst Röhm. The morning of the 22nd, he had held a meeting not only with SA Chief Ernst Röhm, but also with Walter Stennes. Stennes was a tricky character. Only the previous year he had held, as leader of the SA in Berlin and Brandenburg, a revolt against Goebbels and Hitler over poor pay within the SA and the slow pace taken by Hitler since the Beerhold Putsch in 1923 to take power legally rather than through force. That morning they met because the SS, since 1929 under the command of Heinrich Himmler, was operating as a separate force to the SA, to which the three could find some common ground in their opposition of. The NSDAP members of the hall and the SA stand as Goebbels enters, and there is a sudden cheer of "Germany awake!" They cheer and whistle, but it does not go unnoticed to Goebbels that there is, to his eye, at least 1,000 communists in the crowd, whose boos are audible amongst the cries of his own supporters. He walks quickly and purposefully towards the stage. Dressed in a suit with his characteristic slick-backed hair, he charged forwards, but appears dwarfed when surrounded by the men of the SS. He quite easily could have entered through the rear of the building and quietly taken a place upon the stage, but that would not have the dramatic effect that he so desired. Reaching the front, he climbs the steps, passes behind Ulbricht, and the other invited members, and takes a seat at the center of the table. Nodding, he allows the proceedings to continue. The chairman, who had opened the meeting with a forceful warning, then opened the floor to discussion, and a young Social Democrat stepped forward. The Social Democratic leaders had shrugged the NSDAP-organized meeting off, and none of the heads of the party had bothered to show. So it was to this young, inexperienced Social Democrat to speak to the crowd on behalf of his party. He carried himself with little confidence and reached the rostrum. With a small voice in the large hall, he cries,
"Worker brothers, worker sisters,"
he cries to a hall that is agitated and sitting only on the fringes, neither side from the extreme left of the KPD and their paramilitary forces, the Red Front, or the NSDAP and their own paramilitary SA, want to hear from someone who both consider an enemy and sits in the middle as a representative of a regime that neither like, and eventually both would unite to try and take down in the form of the Social Democratic-led Prussian Landtag. Again, the Social Democrat cries,
"Worker brothers, worker sisters."
And again, he falls silent, nervous and exasperated. Falling down at the first hurdle in his political race, he tries again to struggle on.
"Worker brothers, worker sisters,"
he cries one more time. This time the crowd, perhaps through boredom and wishing for the young man to continue, responds,
"We have no work,"
came the lame cry. Weakly, he carries on, but with momentum not playing into his favour, he ends his speech with haste and returns meekly to his seat. In returning so quickly, he allows for Walter Ulbricht, KPD leader in the Berlin-Brandenburg, more time to stand behind the rostrum. 4 years older than Goebbels, at the age of 37, his hair is already receding at the centre, making his large forehead more prominent. His eyes are thin and set beneath short, thick, dark eyebrows. His nose is long, protruding and bent to the right, beneath which is a moustache, well-groomed and cleared from the philtrum, and with a little hair on the lower jaw as well, which serves to try and hide the almost missing chin, he attempts an emulation of Lenin. His gaze and demeanour isn't calm and reserved. His gaze pensive, soft, but inquiring. Behind the rostrum he stands. A shout heralds through the hall.
"Rot front."
And he begins to speak. For the counterpart in terms of leadership to Goebbels, he is quite the opposite in his mannerisms. He does not flail his arms around or litter his text with the rhetorical questions that Goebbels asked, having already decided on the answer. He begins addressing the points that Schulz and Mainshausen had made on Marxism and socialism, first starting with the National Socialists' understanding nothing at all about socialism, and explains to the crowd that just like the National Socialist leaders, the social fascists, meaning the Social Democrats, are on the other side of the barricade, a point that Leon Trotsky was opposed to as it divided the opposition to the growing wave of nationalism by alienating the Social Democrats and reduced the impact that communists could have, especially in Germany, where they were the largest communist party outside of the Soviet Union. After his opening address, he continues to speak over the issues that the nation was facing, beginning with the Young Plan, which the communist press consistently referred to as the Young Slavery. The Young Plan was the redrawing of the Treaty of Versailles in 1929 in an attempt to try and find more favourable terms for Germany. It was one of the last great pieces of work to which Gustav Stresemann represented Germany on before his untimely death in October of the same year, just a few months prior to the Young Plan's adoption. But it was a plan that, even though it reduced the reparation payments by 20%, still committed Germany to paying them and tie the finances of the nation. It also had led Heinrich Brüning, the Chancellor, cutting even more of the state expenditure, i.e. the unemployment money to which most who had gathered in the hall were focusing on. But Brüning, according to Ulbricht, had done little against the industries. He spoke,
"Are not the German entrepreneurs the slave owners of international finance capital? Aren't the Siemens, Borsig, Klöckner, Kirchdorf and Co., who themselves earned hundreds of millions from the reparation loans and still do, the henchmen of international high finance? isn't Brüning's 48 tax?
Meaning here a tax the Chancellor had introduced with emergency decree by powers granted to him by Article 48 of the Weimar Constitution.
Which both Flick and the Social Democrat Braun agree to in the Reich Council, the plundering of young people. But who fights against it? Who fights against German international finance capital? Those who fight against it are those who try to prevent this plundering of the people by all means. 65,000 rural comrades are fighting against the wage robbery. The Christian Minister of Labour, Stegewald, promised the coal barons 10% cuts in wage. It took a strike by the rural miners to force Stegewald to reduce this number to 6%. This was the revolutionary mass struggle against the collection of the young tributes and against the squeezing of the tributes for the Christian and German capitalists from the bones of the workers. This is a fight against the young slavery. This is the fight against the monopolistical price gouging of big businesses. This is the fight against wage and slave robbery through head taxes and tobacco taxes. The only party that will lead the people in this struggle and win victory over the people plunderers is the Communist Party. Not with the white mice and blind worms, but with the weapon of the strike, the workers will fight for their demands for life.
With an arm blasting forth, Walter Ulbricht points to the NSDAP Gauleiter Goebbels and continues.
The leaders of the NSDAP, together with Severing's police,
Severing being the Minister of the Interior of Prussia,
not only did they prevent the fight against the young tributes, but denied their main slogan of the 14th of September 1930. At that time they shouted, "Tear up the young plan, not a penny for young tribute." But a few weeks later, on the 25th of October, the National Socialist representative on the Reichstag committee, Herr Reventlow, declared, "The Nazis never demanded the tearing up of the young plan." So the meetings of the big industrialists with Herr Hitler had obvious successes. The National Socialist deputies vote against the communist motion to stop the young's payments immediately. The Nazi leaders' Council of Ministers led to open betrayals of the voters. "General strike against young," cried Herr Goebbels before in Der Angriff, but quickly after Hitler's negotiations, you no longer read a word about the general strike against young.
Turning to Schulz, Walter Ulbricht addresses a point that Schulz had made in his so-called rambling speech.
The speaker, Herr Schulz explained, "We are trying to strangle capitalism in a different way." All the people present are waiting anxiously. Report how? But the speaker remains silent. He also says nothing about the fight against ministers and corruption salaries, the most important National Socialist slogan so far. Why do you think? We certainly agree with the National Socialist workers that the young government and its ministers should be allowed to have their penny. We believe that the National Socialist workers and employers at least agree completely with the view of the KPD. But what? What did the Nazis do? On the 17th of January, they granted Herr Dietrich, who wants to rob the unemployed and do forced labour for the working people, not only a salary bonus of 4,800 marks, but also 2,250 marks for the luxurious furnishings of his apartment. The Nazis say that they lead the fight against the plunderers of the people, but in reality they give them huge subsidies. Before every National Socialist worker, employee, and small businessman is the question. With the communists against the capital skunks, against the German slaveholders of the international finance capital, against the bookers and sliders, or with the capitalists and the National Socialist leaders against the revolutionary workers. The national liberation of the toiling people from the shackles of the Young Plan is possible not with, but only against the German exploiters and their government. The victory of the working people over the exploiters and slaveholders in their own country, that at the same time the flying fight for the national liberation of the German people, that is the only way to bread, work, and freedom. That is the tearing apart of the Young Plan. Look at the Soviet Union, which has freed itself from all enemies. Long live the united front of the fighting proletariat and all toilers against plundering the people. Young slavery and fascism. Long live Soviet Germany.
For 45 minutes, Walter Ulbricht had spoken almost entirely uninterrupted. His points are hard placed, and many are placed in reality. The Nazis were courting industry and many were starting to fund the party itself, companies that included Mercedes-Benz. Despite Hitler's own National Socialist views and speeches decrying capitalism as the enemy, he courted it. As did Goebbels. All to win influence and power. Often Goebbels had made speeches, or Der Angriff had written within its papers of fighting against the Young Plan, or supporting the workers, but on the other hand, only serving what was best for themselves. The most iconic is, as Olbricht highlighted, the National Socialist promise of clearing corruption within the salaries of ministers, and ultimately when the Nazis came to occupy German government, they would become the most corrupt. The cheers from the communist contingent within the crowd were loud as Walter Ulbricht came to sit down once more at the long table. It was now time for Goebbels. Outside, the night had dropped cooler. Most who had gathered earlier had departed as the hours had ticked by, and the cold seeped into their bones, preferring to find warmth at home or in a beer hall they could gain entry to, not one that they stood jealously in the glow of. Grzynski, the social democratic head of the police, who themselves were only headquartered a short drive from the Saalbau Friedrichshain, must have detected that this night was not going to be the usual night. For the opposing parties to walk on the same street as one another was hardly possible. In Prenzlauerberg on Danziger Strasse, the two opposing fronts occupied two opposing restaurants, and even though they never ate or drank together, they often were found in the tram tracks locked together in their scuffles. Now they were in the same hall, speaking at the same event, thousands of weapons of politics ready to explode at any moment. Grzynski deployed 9 armoured cars to blockade Am Friedrichshain, the main street that ran near, and placed many more pairs of boots upon the ground, ready, waiting, for anything that might erupt, their gummy knuppel or truncheons easily accessible to their hands. They stood. Goebbels stood, his chair scratches on the wooden floor as he pushes it back. Slowly he walks forward and reaches the spot on which Ulbricht had occupied for the last 45 minutes. Leaning with both hands on the rostrum, he is about to launch into his diatribe in retort to Ulbricht. But no sooner has his jaw fallen open for the first large inhalation of air to begin his lambasting of the KPD leader's efforts against him, does the crowd strike up into a chorus of the Internationale, drowning out any attempts of Goebbels to speak. Then the atmosphere takes a different turn, when a chair makes its passage from ground into air. Who threw the first chair, no one could say. The communists would naturally blame it on the fascists, and the fascists would blame it on the communists in return. Nevertheless, the air was slowly filling with chairs. To their feet, with more animation than most had shown through the past over 2 hours of speeches, the supporters of the party stood. Hands quickly grasped at the chair backs, and quickly, with no accuracy and no understanding onto whom it might land, the chairs were flung. From the small balcony facing the stage, chairs began to rain down. For those who did not fall into the paramilitary camp or did not support their parties with such gusto, they made, in a stampede, for the exit like bulls running but from the red as opposed towards it. Many fell on their way to the door and were trampled underfoot. Others fell to the floor with blood seeping from their heads where chairs had cracked their skulls. Soon, however, it was no longer chairs falling through the air, but chair legs and hands that were the danger. The SS rushed forward to the stage and grabbed at Goebbels. Ulbricht skulked away. As the hall emptied of the workers, or the former workers, it began to fill with the shiny boots of the Schuppo. Through the side doors and onto the stage, they appeared and forced their way into the crowd, gummy knuckles raised and ready to strike a blow if required. Goebbels, cowering now under the protection of the SS, and in particular of his SS adjutant Georg Kubisch, hides from view. Kubisch was loyal to the National Socialist cause, and had begun initially working as Goebbels' driver before being promoted to take on permanently as his adjutant. But either through the Schuppo or through a chair flying through the air, Kubisch received a heavy blow to the head that left him falling to the ground, severely injured. Goebbels, under protection of both the SS and the police, is hurried out now that the police had managed to clear an area to exit. Into the cold of the night he is whisked, and swiftly into the back of his Mercedes. Inside, the communists were winning the fight against the fascists. For almost 2 hours, the large brawl of politically charged fought with one another. Chair legs were still held in hands, but some fists were now adorned with brass, knuckle dusters concealed within jacket pockets or within the brim of a worker's flat cap, now cut through the air and knocked teeth from mouths and heads to the ground. One person was captured by the shuppel, wielding a wrench. It seemed highly unlikely that a plumber thought maintenance work would be necessary at that moment. Daggers were found on the floor and quickly taken away. One worker, whilst resisting arrest, was found to have a pistol, which naturally was confiscated. After 2 hours had passed, the shupper was finally able to gain control of the Zaubau Friedrichshain, but the hall was a scene of devastation. The next day, the owners would enter to assess the damage, which, in terms of chairs, amounted to 500 chairs smashed. Goebbels had escaped uninjured. He simply wrote the following morning,
"Big hullabaloo, tired, home, still slaving deep into the night."
The shupper had managed to forcibly detain 34 people. They did not state as to which party they belonged. Naturally, the communist papers decried that they were all either SA or party members, but realistically, this could not be true. If, as their paper claimed, they won the day and conquered the hall, it would stand to reason that they probably would have been the easier ones for the shupper to arrest. However, when all had cleared the next day, over 100 people had been injured. Some so badly injured were they that they were put into cars and quickly driven to the hospitals. 5 were taken to Bethanien Hospital with severe skull fractures. The majority of the other badly injured, but not life-threatening, were taken to rescue centres and bandaged. Goebbels' adjutant, Kubisch, would make a recovery and later would go on to marry Hitler's first mistress, Maria Reiter, who had become Hitler's love interest when she was just 16 years old. Kubisch would die as an SS soldier during the assault on Dunkirk. Hitler sent Maria 100 red roses on hearing of the news. For the Battle of Friedrichshain, the Vosges Zeitung wrote the morning after, "In a National Socialist rally that took place last night in Zaubau Friedrichshain, to which the communists were invited, there were riots of a kind never before experienced in Berlin at a political meeting." Little over 2 years later, the Nazis would come to power and quickly seize total power. And the street fighting between communists and National Socialists would come to an end when the National Socialist regime purged the supporters from the state and often from life. Over 150,000 KPD members would be imprisoned during the Third Reich, and 30,000 would die. As for Walter Ulbricht, who skulked away from the hall that night, during the Third Reich, he would spend his time in exile, before returning and himself becoming dictator of East Germany. You have been listening to the Achtung History Podcast, presented by myself, Simon J. James, and produced by the BerlinTourGuide.com. You can find out more about the Achtung History Podcast at the BerlinTourGuide.com/Achtung History, follow on Instagram and Twitter at Achtung History, or support the Achtung History Podcast on patreon.com/Achtung History.